I don't consider myself the world's biggest Beatles guy, but that's largely because I've interacted with dudes who nerd out about the Beatles more than I can nerd out about anything. And considering that I do a weekly Movie Dork podcast while I rant about a different movie every week, I think that says something. Mm-hmm. I've met guys who like go into, on this song, it was recorded on this date with this person playing instruments and so on and so forth, and I've never been able to get that far into the weeds. I am a big Beatles guy by normal people standards, though. I listen to music primarily on an old iPod Classic modified to hold 2 terabytes of data. And yes, I do this in 2023, even though that's a very 2011 thing to do.
Hey, those iPods were cool as shit back in the day.
It has every Beatles studio album on it, as well as a fair number of the better solo records and various bits of esoteric matter like the Escher demos, Let It Be Naked, the cleaned up version of the Hollywood Bowl live album from the Ron Howard documentary where you can actually hear the band over the screaming teenagers, and the Cirque du Soleil remix album. Like Paul McCartney, I think the Cirque du Soleil Beatles Love record is fine, but I kind of wish that they took bolder creative chances with it. It's kind of boring and safe by my reckoning. I like the Beatles is what I'm trying to say. I first dove into Beatles fandom when the One compilation album came out when I was a teenager. I used to listen to it on my Discman when I walked to my first job as a supermarket bag boy.
That was also my first exposure to the Beatles, except I listened to it on a CD player endlessly and I was like 8 or 9 years old.
Yeah, there was a big Beatles push in the late 90s. And I remember my Discman, for a while, like half the headphones would be out, so there was moments in paperback writer where I didn't hear half the song. Because the early Beatles songs, 4-track, recorded on a 4-track, rather. But yeah, what really hooked me on the Beatles, however, was Yellow Submarine. It got a DVD release roughly at the same time that One came out, and I fell in love with both the reissued soundtrack album and the wild, psychedelic, and endlessly creative visuals of the film itself. When I first laid out my plans for this Movie Dork podcast, in fact, I included a list of all the movies I wanted to talk about at some point or another on the show. Yellow Submarine is one of the last ones on that list that I've yet to get around to, so this is a big deal for me.
Yeah, but that's pretty impressive, though. This podcast is what now? 4 years old?
Getting there. I'm approaching 200 episodes.
Damn.
That list had like 20 movies on it, so I've been putting off Yellow Submarine for a while.
Yeah. Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Anyways, my name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive. And joining me on this episode, as she's already introduced herself, is Rachel.
Hello. I would say I'm also a normal amount of a Beatles fan. I saw the Beatles group that was like a pretty good Beatles impersonator group. I forget.
Oh, the Fab Four?
No, it was different than that. I'm trying to remember what it was called. Beatles One or something? I don't remember, but I paid a lot of money to go and see the Beatles reenactors. And I also did, 10 years ago, I got to see Ringo Starr and his all-star band with my dad. And it was really cool, and at the end, he played Yellow Submarine, and everyone sang along. And my dad's like, that was worth the price of admittance, for that.
I mean, that song was constructed specifically to be a pub sing-along, so yeah, that's what it's for.
But it was fun, I could say that I sung along with it with the Ringo Starr.
Yeah, the only Beatles tribute act I've seen is the Magical Mystery Doors, and they're kind of a hybrid act, as the name implies.
But that's an interesting idea, though, to combine them that way. But I had a Beatles shirt that I wore. I said they were my favorite band when I was in the I'm not like other girls phase of tweenhood.
Yeah, I had an Abbey Road t-shirt when I was in high school, and I wore that thing through the bone, and then one that finally fell apart, I just bought another one and wore that one through.
When I was in London as a student, I did not go and take the annoying photo and get almost run over by cars, although a couple people I knew did. I did go in the little Beatles shop and walked around. It was kind of cutesy and very expensive.
I have a couple of the Todd McFarlane Yellow Submarine action figures that he put out in 99, roughly when the movie got reissued on DVD, and they're in my parents' attic somewhere. I have no idea how much they're worth. Probably like $5.
And it's kind of funny, though, because the Beatles shop is right next to the Sherlock Holmes Museum in London, which I feel like is very fitting.
Yeah, we're talking about those various bits of pop culture that are there to make people sort of forget the horrific British imperialism of the 19th and early 20th century. You know, the Beatles and Sherlock Holmes are definitely on there,
Yeah.
alongside like Harry Potter and Monty
Yeah, maybe not
Python.
Harry Potter these days. J.K. Rowling kind of poisoned that well.
It's
Doctor
weird that
Who.
it's yeah, Doctor Who's on there. It's weird if James Bond is on there, considering how imperialist it is, but we're getting off topic. Plot recap.
Yes,
All right.
such as there is.
I should also mention, you saw Yellow Submarine for the first time a couple of days ago.
Like 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, with you. I mean, I had always wanted to see it. I knew who the Blue Meanie was from the Ultimate Showdown of Ultimate Destiny, which I sang to you before we started recording. But yeah, I mean, I knew like the basics of it. I was also very shocked to learn that the Beatles don't voice themselves.
However, you did seem pleasantly surprised by the movie. It was a lot better than you thought it was
Yeah,
going to
I
be.
thought it was gonna be like kind of some sort of, I don't know, bile fascination weird movie that it's like you gotta see it at least once. I thought it was beautiful and I was really impressed and I had a great time.
Yeah, the one that you can sort of see once as a curio and then you never seem to see it again is Help, but we'll get back to that. Plot recap. All right, this movie takes place in Pepperland primarily, a cheerful, music-loving paradise under the sea, home to Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The titular Yellow Submarine rests on top of a ziggurat, and at the edge of the land is a range of high blue mountains. This is home to the music-hating Blue Meanies, who launch a surprise attack on Pepperland at the beginning of the film. They open with a music-proof glass globe that imprisons Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and then they fire projectiles and drop apples on top of Pepperland's citizens, rendering them immobile and docile as statues.
That made me laugh that it was apples, because I was like, was Apple like the Beatles music label?
Yes, it
It's a
is.
little biting the hand that feeds them a
Yeah, it's biting their own hand. They own that
bit.
label. They literally drain the countryside of color. At the last minutes before his capture, Pepperland's elderly Lord High Mayor sends Old Fred to get help. Lord Mayor refers to Old Fred as Young Fred, but the Beatles refer to him as Old Fred.
Well, it's kind of funny when you think about it, though, because like with my dad, my mom calls him, you know, Joe. To his mom, he is Joey, and because his father was Joe. But there were also like aunts and uncles who called my grandfather Joey because to them he was still the little boy.
But yeah, the Lord Mayor gets bonked into immobility by the Apple Bonkers, part of the Blue Meanie Army.
They have nice hats.
Old Fred travels to Liverpool in the Yellow Submarine, where he follows a depressed Ringo Starr to the pier, a building on the top of a hill, and persuades him to return to Pepperland with him. Ringo collects his mates, John, Paul, and George, and eventually they all decide to help out Old Fred and journey back with him on Pepperland in the submarine. They first go through the Sea of Time, where they age down to their boyhood and then age up into their elderly status. Then they eject Ringo into the Sea of Monsters and have to rescue him while this vacuum-sucking demon walks around, just eating everything, including the background eventually.
I thought was very Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, we'll get to that. In the Sea of Nothing, they meet Jeremy Hillary Boob, PhD, or as Ringo puts it, FUD. That makes me laugh every time. A short and studious and rather pompous and pretentious creature, a real nowhere man.
Didn't I call him the Tom Bombadil of the Yellow Submarine?
Well, he contributes more than the Tom Bombadil because the Yellow Submarine has a busted motor and Jeremy finds a way to fix it. Ringo, taking pity on Jeremy, asks him to accompany them because he's alone and very sad.
Aww.
They arrive at the foothills of the headlands where they are accidentally separated by the submarine and Old Fred due to Jeremy repairing the submarines without them on board.
Whoops.
They then find themselves in the Sea of Holes, where Ringo picks up a hole and puts it in his pocket. Jeremy is kidnapped by a Blue Meanie at this point, but then they find the Sea of Green and eventually make their way to Pepperland.
The room full of holes really reminded me a SpongeBob SquarePants episode. It's like SpongeBob 2000, where like it's the one where Squidward goes, "Future, future," and he ends up in that blank space where he is alone, alone, alone.
I mean, I'd be shocked if the SpongeBob people had never seen Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
Reuniting with old Fred and reviving the apple-bonked Lord Mayor with a tune, they look upon Pepperland's now miserable gray landscape and resolve to do something about it. However, because they lost their instruments in the Sea of Monsters and the Blue Meanies have confiscated everything, they dress up as Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and sneak into the compound where the instruments are kept to steal them. The four then rally the land to rebellion. The Chief Blue Meanie retaliates by sending out the dreadful Flying Glove, which John Lennon defeats with like verbalizing the lyrics of All You Need Is Love. Pepperland has restored the color as the residents revive and the flowers rebloom. Ringo uses the hole in his pocket to release the Lonely Hearts Club Band from their imprisonment. They're essentially the Beatles' doppelgangers. And for most of the movie, Rachel thought that those were going to be the group that was voiced by the actual Beatles.
Yeah, I did. And so they show up at the end. I'm like, of course they're gonna play the doppelgangers. It's like, no, they have a little like live-action cameo right at the end.
The two groups of bands take out the multi-headed bulldog, and then Ringo rescues Jeremy, who performs some transformation magic on the Chief Blue Meanie, infesting him with flowers, which causes him to finally concede defeat. Although, he was hanging on till the end, he was screaming at his troops to retreat backwards. You're advancing the wrong way. John Lennon extends an offer of friendship, which the Chief Blue Meanie accepts eventually, conceding that, although he never wanted to admit it, his cousin is the Bluebird of Happiness.
Aww.
We then cut to a vignette as an epilogue or denouement, where the live-action Beatles show us their souvenirs from the adventure in a playful manner. George has the motor, Paul has a bit of the love that he manifested, and Ringo has half of a hole in his pocket. He gave the other half to Jeremy to fix it to keep his mind from wandering. Ringo points out John is looking through a telescope, and John very horrifically recites that some blue meanies are in the vicinity of the very theater showing the film, and the only way to fight back is through singing. That brings about All Together Now, which ends with translations of the song's title in various languages.
And the end.
Yeah, end of film.
It was fun. I really liked it. I was like, wow, this is just so beautiful the whole time.
Yeah, this movie's a pretty big deal for my family. Toby, when he was very young, he had a hard time sleeping at night, and there was a while where we would just do a routine where he'd put on my old copy of the 1999 reissue of the Yellow Submarine soundtrack, and that would just help him drift off.
Aw, that's so sweet!
And my second cousin's baby Jesse, who was on the podcast for the House episode, and Jake, one time I was down in Florida, and I brought Yellow Submarine with me, and incidentally, they got super into it. They were at that age where they were watching movies over and over again, and yeah, they blitzed through Yellow Submarine 50 or 60 times, drove their parents nuts. And I'm not saying that created baby Jesse's interest in musical theater. They were already well on that train well before that happened, but it might have helped things along a little bit. For the development of this, the Beatles were displeased with 1965's Help. We talked about Help a little bit on the podcast episode where my siblings and I compared A Hard Day's Night to Spice World. Not sure if I'll be uploading that one before this one. But at the risk of repeating myself too much here, I agree with the Beatles themselves. There are people out there who will defend Help, but not me. I think that Help is draggy, incoherent, and also shockingly racist for something that came out in the second half of the 20th century.
This is my first Beatles movie, period, dot, so...
Okay, well, the plot of Help, such as it is, it's a big mess. Well, the Beatles didn't help it because they were not taking the role seriously. They were high as balls through most of it. It's very obvious. But the plot surrounds Ringo receiving a sacred ring from an Indian cult that worships Kali, and they're basically dodging a bunch of Indian religious extremists who want to sacrifice Ringo most of the movie.
Wait, that's real?
Yeah.
No. Okay, yeah, that sounds awful.
Anyways, the Beatles didn't like that movie, but they still owed United Artists a third movie.
Whoops.
They saw an animated film as an easy way to fulfill the contract without contributing too much.
Yeah, like, I get to say my lines into a microphone in my pajamas, and then they didn't even do that.
At the same time, Walt Disney wanted the Beatles to appear in the Jungle Book. That's why the vultures have mop tops.
Oh, I thought that it was just because the Beatles were popular.
No, those were supposed to be the actual Beatles, but they dropped out of that as well. It was long rumored that Yellow Submarine was challenged by United Artists due to having almost no Beatles involvement, and that's how the Let It Be documentary came about, but this is not the case. The Let It Be documentary is a whole separate mess that I am not going to get into here. Producer Al Brodax was brought in because he supervised the animated Beatles TV series.
I did not know that existed either.
It is not very good. The band themselves hated this cartoon, and they started finding reasons to not voice themselves in the film. United Artists required them to film a brief epilogue at the end of the movie to fulfill their contract at that point. When they had seen a bunch of test footage, they were pleasantly surprised by the visuals, and at that point they were enthusiastic about appearing in the movie. Brodax had about 40 animators on staff and 7 cameras, thanks to the pre-existing Beatles cartoon, all located in various areas in Soho, London. He brought in somewhere between 170 to 200 layout artists to complement that crew. The film went into production without a finished script, completed storyboards, or even final character designs.
Man, this is the Wild West out there.
Yeah, when we're talking about non-Disney animated films between the 1930s and, I say, the 80s when Don Bluth got started, we're going to hear a lot of stories like this.
Doesn't surprise me one bit.
Canadian animator George Dunning, who had worked on the Beatles TV series as well, was selected by Brodax to direct. Dunning's longtime business partner John Coates was a supervising animator. Dunning had worked for UPA on the Gerald McBoing Boing show. Go back to our podcast episode on John Hubley if you all want more details about that. And he briefly supervised UPA's London office before UPA couldn't afford to maintain the London office anymore. His own short films that he made through Canadian grants were noteworthy for their embrace of surrealism and using low-budget, limited animation techniques in very creative ways. That's kind of UPA's bread and butter. That's probably why he worked for them. Dunning was given a paltry $250,000 budget and 11 months to complete the film.
That's nothing.
Yeah, a typical animated film of that era took 4 years to complete. Dunning quadrupled his staff, and he paid for extra expenses out of his own director's fee. According to his own account, he basically broke even through Yellow Submarine.
Aw, man.
Yeah, unfortunately for Dunning, he accepted a flat fee with no back-end deal.
No!
So when Yellow Submarine was released to great fanfare and success, he got no royalties or residual checks.
Poor bastard.
The biggest contributor to Yellow Submarine's unique aesthetic was art director Heinz Edelman. This was his first film.
What else did he do beforehand?
Mostly graphic design, maybe some TV commercials.
Alright, that makes sense.
Brodax hired him early on as art director, but Edelman was strung along without a serious commitment or any kind of contract or tangible paycheck, and eventually started getting frustrated with this. At the height of his anger, Edelman conjured a series of twisted creatures that ultimately became the Blue Meanies.
That worked out in the long run.
According to Edelman's assistant, Millicent McMillan, Edelman initially wanted the Blue Meanies to be purple, but she felt that it would be difficult to translate the purple colors to film stock in a way that would carry over to prints, and she talked him into the Blue Meanies.
Plus, Blue Meanie sounds better than Purple Meanies.
Yeah, although, as Coates put it, they are intended to be Blue Meanies from the onset, so who knows? Pop artist Peter Max is occasionally misattributed as the art director of the film. This is understandable, as he had a very similar style, but he was not involved in any capacity whatsoever. Edelman hated the cutesy realism of Disney, and he gave the Meanies Mickey Mouse ears as sort of an eye poke.
Yeah, I was like, hey, they got the Mickey Mouse thing going on. I mean, you know, everyone wants to make fun of Disney.
Yeah, he didn't like that they were the dominant aesthetic voice in film and just wanted to do essentially the opposite of that. Pauline Kael, in her rave review for Yellow Submarine, remarked upon Yellow Submarine as sort of an anti-Disney feature movie.
I can feel that.
Coates cited the translation of Edelman's cutout designs to be the principal challenge of the film. And like he said, he described them as cutouts, and he thought they looked very good as drawings, but it caused a lot of headaches, like wondering how each character was supposed to move.
Yeah, it's not like South Park, where they just like go do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
He said particularly challenging was the bulldog, which is like a pack of bulldogs, but they're also kind of one thing, like this twisted little Cerberus thing. And he was like, okay, which leg moves first? How does it go? And eventually he decided that they're supposed to walk in a sort of like crab-like shuffle.
Whatever works.
And 40 years later, in a retrospective interview, he's like, I guess it looks all right. I think we did the best we could. And then Edelman went into detail over how he wanted each Beatle to walk. I think he wanted Paul McCartney to walk as a sort of, like, a showman. He thought he was, like, the ritziest, most old-fashioned Beatle. Moved more to, like, a Frank Sinatra or Fred Astaire, or kind of like that. And since Ringo is the shortest one, he has a lower frame rate in his rate of walking.
I noticed that.
In general, there's a lot of limited animation in for Yellow Submarine in general. This is animated on fours, and it definitely looks like it.
It does, but it feels like it fits, though.
Yeah, like UPA, Yellow Submarine uses its limited budget in order to force creativity. Lots of it made me think of the Dover Boys, where you have that squash and stretch, and things flipping back and forth, and...
I'm hand her, Dan, backslide!
Yeah. But because it's animated on fours, there's a sort of herky-jerky thing to it. And, I mean, this comes up every time I mention technical terms like that. When I say animated on fours, that means one drawing is used for four frames, and then it's another drawing. That's fairly slow, that's why they move like that, and as I put it, the herky-jerky way.
It seemed to fit. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, a contrast to that would be Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is animated on ones. That means one drawing per frame, which is insane.
But I feel like you need that, though, because...
They're interacting with humans.
Yep.
Charlie Jenkins supervised the Eleanor Rigby sequence, which is one of the more celebrated parts of the Yellow Submarine film. That one used newsreel footage and traced over animations of the actual cast and crew. That's when you asked me how much rotoscoping was in the film.
Yeah, but it did look... It was really cool, though. It's like, I don't have any complaints. Like, whatever was lacking, it's like, it works.
Every time they employed something that would save money or cut costs or just make things cheaper, they always introduced it in a very stylized way that gives off when this is an artistic choice.
And you're like, all right, yeah. That's great.
Jenkins also did the Liverpool splashdown sequence with the first entering the sea in the Yellow Submarine, and he also did the Only a Northern Song moment, which is probably the part where the film is the most like a psychedelic poster.
I agree.
Brodax is not sure how the animation team managed the effect of the sunrise transitioning to the Liverpool street scene with a sort of 3D effect, like right before Eleanor Rigby starts. They did not have a multiplane camera, which would have explained that. So,
miracle.
Yeah, Brodax said it was an accident, and they didn't know how they could do that again. Coates also said that making the movie within 11 months was a miracle.
I can feel like their memory must have, vented just a little bit because of how crazy it was.
Yeah, the backgrounds were supervised by McMillan, who was Edelman's assistant, and also Alison DeVere. A lot of interesting stuff with there. I think the background people pretty much always show up to work, no matter what animated film we're talking about, but especially in this one. There's so many little details.
Yes.
And you could just go buck wild. Edelman's directive was that Yellow Submarine was to be a series of loosely connected vignettes and that it was okay for various scenes to look wildly different from each other.
But that's what I liked it. I never knew what to expect next.
Edelman is just like, I don't want anyone to get bored while watching this, so we're just going to flip the script every time there's a scene change.
Yep, I was not bored at all.
The Lucy in the Sky sequence, the most heavily rotoscope part of the film, was suggested by Dunning, but he was busy with other parts of the movie at the time. So while it does employ the rotoscoping on glass technique that he employed in his own experimental shorts, Bob Balson handled most of the grunt work of that. They modeled it after test footage and bits of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers musicals.
That does not surprise me at all.
out of the crew, 150 people working on the film were women. So it sort of turned into a bacchanal as everyone was just sort of stuck together. if you were a theater geek, especially when you were younger.
Yes.
Yeah, if everyone's crammed into a room...
Everyone is horny and it smells like hairspray.
Yeah, yeah, they're going to be hookups. Yellow Submarine resulted in 5 marriages and 13 children.
Oh, man. Can you imagine being like, yeah, I exist because of the Beatles' Yellow Submarine?
Australian animator Anne Toleave couldn't attend the premiere because she was giving birth.
Damn.
Coates mentioned that, he brought his wife and little girl to the premiere, and, you know, when the Beatles showed up, they were being sworn by paparazzi, and it's like, oh, I was hoping to get my kid to talk to one of them, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Aww.
But apparently George Harrison ran over and said,
Well, that's why he's my favorite Beatle.
For the writing of this, Lee Minhoff is credited with coming up with the basic plot, although it's based on the song, obviously. But 14 screenplays were completed before they settled on something.
That's a lot of screenplays.
Al Brodax, Jack Mendelsohn, and Eric Siegel all have writing credits. But when complaints of the dialogue being too American started to roll in, Roger McGough added some uncredited punch-ups. It's agreed that the various puns, double entendres, Liverpool slang words, and references to Beatles lyrics all came from him. So it was just like, okay, so everything in the dialogue that made me laugh was McGough. It is weird that he is the only one who isn't credited.
Oh, local jokes get local folks.
I think I burnt me finger. All right, for the cast for this, not the Beatles, we have John Clive as John Lennon.
My least favorite Beatle.
Clive was apparently neighbors with John Lennon in New York in the last few years of Lennon's life. He kept saying, like, I kept meaning to telephone him and going, hello, John, it's John in my movie voice, but I never did, and now I regret not doing it.
Oh, okay, that made me sad.
Clive said that Yellow Submarine is his daughter's favorite movie.
Aww.
And she was a little girl when she first got into it. And when John Lennon was assassinated, she thought that her dad was John Lennon. So...
Aww.
He had to call her up because he was out doing some kind of workplace thing and convince her that he wasn't dead.
That is so sad. How old was she?
He didn't mention, but she must have been very, very young. Yeah, in retrospect, he tried to make lemons from lemonades and said that this was kind of a sign of how that movie connected with young people and how so many people got into the Beatles because of the movie. And that is why he was happy that he's associated with it in any capacity. Then we have Geoffrey Hughes as Paul McCartney. He is a British stage and TV lifer. I do not know most of his credits because I'm not that familiar with the history of British film. Producers of Yellow Submarine felt that the actual Beatles sounded too similar to each other. So they tasked Edelman and the animation directors with coaching the voice actors to be a little more distinguished from each other. So they're just like, okay, Paul is going to have the highest sounding voice, and Ringo's going to be our bass guy, and George is going to be like the transcendent, I'm above all of this guy, and John Lennon's going to be a snarky little bitch.
That is exactly everyone's public perception of the Beatles boiled down to the bare minimum.
And that is a riff on the characters they're playing in A Hard Day's Night anyways. So that's essentially what Hughes does. Okay, we sort of have Peter Bafton as George Harrison. Huge asterisk in that. He didn't finish his dialogue because he was arrested as a military deserter. He was supposed to be stationed in Germany at the time.
It's like, I was in a Beatles movie. I can't come to work today.
His role was completed by Paul Angelis, who was essentially holding down everything. He was the narrator of the movie. He was Ringo Starr. He was the second half of George Harrison, and more important than anything else, he was the chief blue meanie. Although I do think that out of the various Beatles, Ringo distinguishes himself the most. He's the first character you meet. He has the most dynamic arc because he's the only one who believes in Jeremy.
Yeah, he gets to be the main character. It's good.
Nothing ever happens to me. Another utility player, long-standing British actor Dick Emery, was Max, the chief blue meanie's little sidekick guy. Keeps saying, no, your blueness.
You can't say yes!
He was the elderly Lord Mayor, and most importantly, he was Jeremy Hillary Boob. Fudd. Cheryl thinks that Jeremy is a delightful character, and Sylvan hates Jeremy.
I have to agree with Sylvan. He is the Jar Jar Binks of this movie.
You said he was Tom Bombadil. Most people like Tom Bombadil.
I don't know. I found him annoying. So he's the Jar Jar Binks of this movie.
But he gives
no offense to Ahmed Best. None whatsoever.
And he gives the Chief Blue Mini his rosy nose. I don't know, I could be a pompous little asshole too, so I kind of sympathize with Jeremy.
Nah, I liked the Blue Meanie more. I mean, look at him walking around in that getup with them boots screaming at people. I mean, who doesn't like that?
I haven't laughed this much since Pompeii. And finally, Lance Percival as Fred. He got the job because he voiced both Paul and Ringo on the animated Beatles TV series, so they had to give him something. He's the closest thing that this movie has to a straight man, and he was badly needed. Everyone else is just being silly and throwing their Liverpool slang around, and he has to be the stuffy guy who keeps the plot moving forward.
It's like the, what was it, that one character that Graham Chapman plays on Monty Python? The Colonel or something?
Yeah, he's kind of like that. Although he's a little more playful and accepting of others' eccentricities than any of Graham Chapman's Colonel characters.
He's like, this sketch is getting too silly.
But yeah, I sympathize with old young Fred because he's in over his head. This responsibility just sort of fell on him, and he's doing his best.
Yeah, he has to drive a yellow submarine.
And he has to get it started, even if there isn't a Blue Meanie attack to get things going. I don't know, find a switch. The music of this film. Yellow Submarine is a jukebox musical using various Beatles songs from the mid to late 1960s, roughly from the Rubber Soul era to Magical Mystery Tour. And I think that the Yellow Submarine track list is a very good assortment of experimental, just fucking around, we're no longer touring so we can play and do whatever we want era of the Beatles, which is my preferred era for the Beatles. There were four previously unreleased songs, all leftovers deemed unsuitable for proper Beatles albums. One of them was All Together Now, which was written by McCartney during the Magical Mystery Tour sessions.
I liked it. It's a good song.
Yeah, it was banged out in six takes with George Martin not even present, and it definitely sounds like it. McCartney was trying to imitate the success of Yellow Submarine, and it also has that sort of late night at the pub, we're all singing along type of thing to it. Another one was It's All Too Much. That one was written by George Harrison after meditating on LSD. Although, after he did that for a little bit, he left it behind. Apparently, Haight-Ashbury was too intense for him. It was recorded a couple of months after Sgt. Pepper's was completed, so it wasn't intended for that album, although it definitely has that vibe. I do think it's a little bit underrated. There are people out there who think that it's kind of half-assed, and I can definitely see where they're coming from, but I always like that line about how all the world is birthday cake, so take a piece, but not too much.
Oh, that is a good line.
And I do like this, how it's used in the film in the very end, before we fade to the real-life Beatles. People compare the illustrations to that as a sort of like a psychedelic Aubrey Beardsley, and yeah, I can get on board with that. Although the British magazine Punch, in their positive notice for the film, compared the aesthetic of the film to Marc Chagall, and I can also get on board with that. All right, then we have Only a Northern Song, which there's no such thing as an underrated Beatles song. The Beatles are one of the most popular bands in the world.
Yep.
All their songs are widely known, but I would say Only a Northern Song is the closest thing we have to a deep cut. This is the spiciest take I'm going to launch here. Only a Northern Ooh. Song is one of my favorite Beatles songs. I love this song. When I was a kid, I was like, wow, the Beatles did techno early. It blew me away, that keyboard part.
I don't think I had heard it before watching this movie, so it was a deep cut for me.
This was a cast-off from Sgt. Pepper's that was written by George Harrison, and it's essentially Harrison bitching about getting shafted on songwriting royalties. Northern Songs was their publishing division, and John Lennon and Paul McCartney got way more residuals from their songwriting credits than George Harrison ever did, and it was starting to stick in his craw.
Which sucks, because All Things Must Pass is a great album.
And yeah, it's one of the many things that sowed their disunion after Epstein died and you can no longer force the Beatles to function together as a unit. And yeah, I remember being amazed by Only a Northern Song, and then later on, years later, finding out that the lyrics are actually petty bitching about songwriting royalties, and I'm like, oh. Although I do really like the trumpet parts in it, which is essentially Paul McCartney picking up a trumpet that he did not know how to play and just fucking around. And then finally we have Hey Bulldog, which was written by John Lennon under the working title of Hey Bullfrog, and it was unfinished, but United Artists wanted one more new song for Yellow Submarine, so Lennon just kind of cranked that out. It does seem very slight in the same way that All Together Now is, but I actually really like Hey Bulldog. I think that piano riff is a motherfucker. I also really like how it's used in the film with the Beatles and their doppelganger Sgt. Pepper's counterparts just torturing that Cerebus bulldog.
That was a good scene.
Speaking of which, that Hey Bulldog scene was included in the British version of Yellow Submarine, but it was removed from the American version of the film, probably for time. It was not restored until the 1999 DVD release, although it has subsequently been included in all versions that have come out afterwards. The score for Yellow Submarine is by George Martin, and I adore this score. I listen to it as itself all the time. In fact, one of the playlists on that aforementioned iPod Classic is just me using every single Beatles song that appears in Yellow Submarine and then the George Martin score. I put that on like every couple of months and I'm always delighted by the little...
Hey, that's a good idea though. There are a lot of scores that I'll just listen to like on their own.
Yeah, all the little Baroque flourishes and the quotes and yeah, just the atmosphere. It really contributes so much to the movie. There is a direct cue of Bach's Air on a G-string. It's used for when the Beatles take out the boxing monster and the Sea of Monsters. You will see unused recycled bits from Good Night and Don't Pass Me By from the White Album, which was about to be released when Yellow Submarine came out, but not quite yet. A 1968 soundtrack album includes the title track, All You Need Is Love, and the four new songs on side A, with the Martin score on side B. It is often seen as the weakest Beatles LP released while the group was still an active band. A 1999 compilation that I mentioned a whole bunch of times already includes every song used in the movie except A Day in the Life. And even then, A Day in the Life is only quoted briefly when the Yellow Submarine splashes into the ocean for the first time. It's at the very end when the horns are rising up. Yellow Submarine was released to widespread critical acclaim and considerable commercial success, although I can't find how much it made exactly.
Do you have a ballpark estimate?
No idea. Oh. Well, whatever it was a healthy profit. The Beatles themselves have publicly praised the film pretty often. John Lennon said that it is how he got his son Sean to connect with the Beatles.
Aww.
And while Sean was a little kid, it was his favorite movie. It was one of those things he watched over and over again, like my second cousins.
Aww.
Paul McCartney said that the film was very witty and well-written and well-designed and a lot of fun to sit through. Harrison, in particular, praised Heinz Edelman's character designs. He said that Edelman is the main reason why the film succeeds on its level, and it's hard to disagree with that. I love the way the characters look.
Yeah, it's like they're caricatures and they're silly, but they're never insulting.
Yeah, John and Ringo's little tie.
Yes.
John Lennon's doofy little mustache and little cat monster and little gangster monsters with the guns coming out of their shoes.
The apple bonkers.
Yellow Submarine was caught up in music rights legal bullshit for years and didn't get a proper home release until 1987. And even then, it was the American version of the movie without Hey Bulldog included. The proper restored version of Yellow Submarine got a home release in 1999, which is when I first got into it. And the film got a frame-by-frame hand-corrected Blu-ray restoration in 2012, which is the version I watched with you.
Okay, so that's the one you have? Mm-hmm. All right. Nice.
Yeah, I gave my old 1999 one to Toby. I think he still has it.
Aw, that's good, though.
Yellow Submarine is one of those few movies that I loved enough to double dip and buy a better, more expensive DVD version years later.
Well, I actually have, because my dad is a Lionel train collector, I have a Yellow Submarine train car. So it is the yellow submarine on like a little flatbed train car O-gauge, if that means anything to, you know, anyone who's into model trains. But if you put like baking powder in it and put it in water, she'll float along. My dad found it when I told him that I had watched it, and we didn't put it back in the tub. But I'm pretty sure it works. It's like 20 years old at this point.
Robert Zemeckis tried to get a remake of Yellow Submarine going in 2009, envisioning it being produced with the same motion capture animation that he employed while directing Beowulf, Monster House, Polar Express, and A Christmas Carol. I hate those movies. I think they're uncanny valley, creepy, awful.
They are. I mean, I will say that I like Monster House because at least everyone is like intentionally cartoony, but all of the other ones suck.
David Tennant was cast as the Chief Blue Meanie.
Which honestly is a good casting, I think.
I don't think it would have saved the movie.
No, it just would have been like, David Tennant, you have all those kids, I guess you gotta pay them bills, huh?
Disney lost interest in funding the film after A Christmas Carol flopped. Zemeckis pitched it to other studios with no luck. I think this was for the best.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I would actually be super interested in a Yellow Submarine remake with modern animation techniques, but not like that.
Yeah. No Uncanny Valley.
Yellow Submarine has been referenced many a time. The Ruddles' 1978 mockumentary All You Need Is Cash, a collaborative project between Monty Python and the original iteration of Saturday Night Live, basically parodied the entirety of the Beatles' career, but did Yellow Submarine bits for the cheese and onion scene. Lisa Simpson has a Yellow Submarine-styled hallucination while getting braces in the 1993 Simpsons episode Last Exit to Springfield. Getting further into the Matt Groening empire, the intro to the 2008 Futurama film Bender's Game references Yellow Submarine. You know how in the intro to every episode of Futurama, the Planet Express ship flies into the screen. In Bender's Game, they fly through the screen and enter Yellow Submarine world. Yellow Submarine is referenced in the Oasis music video for All Around the World, which is off their very divisive third album, which I've never been super fond of. I've been pretty lukewarm about Oasis, even when they were at the height of their power, so I'm the wrong person to ask.
Yeah, I was too young for that.
And apparently Kesha did a Yellow Submarine video at some point.
Okay, I have to check that out because I fucking love Kesha.
Gold Key published a Yellow Submarine tie-in comic in 1968. It is based on an earlier version of the script, so it has a number of differences from the final film. Most notably, Ringo has a romantic subplot with a mermaid named Lovely Rita.
I'm about to say, the one token female Blue Meanie, like the Smurfette. That would have been kind of a distraction, honestly.
Yeah, I can see why they dropped it.
But at least they gave it to Ringo instead of, like, Paul or John.
Years later, on the film's 50th anniversary, Bill Morrison, a Simpsons artist who was also a character designer on Futurama and Disenchanted, adapted and illustrated a Yellow Submarine graphic novel that I'm holding in my hand right here.
It's pretty cool, and you said that it is essentially the movie, but no songs.
Yes, the songs are judiciously edited out, probably for legal reasons. Yellow Submarine was a massive influence on Terry Gilliam.
That does not surprise me one bit.
Yeah, specifically for his transitional animations for Monty Python's Flying Circus, and then later on in, you know, Meaning of Life and
Holy
Grail.
And the animated menace was no more.
Schoolhouse Rock, Sesame Street, and The Electric Company all also borrowed heavily from the film.
Doesn't surprise me one bit either.
Although those various animation houses also employed a number of UPA people, which is where Dunning came from. As far as I could find, only one Yellow Submarine animator worked directly for Children's Television Workshop. And that brings us to themes. So far for the last couple of episodes, I've basically just been falling back on interpreting whatever the subject is through traditional critical lenses for the themes. So I thought I'd just cycle through that for this one. An obvious one would be auteur theory. I like to go through, as I mentioned already, Patrick Willems' definition of auteur theory, which isn't necessarily placing it upon the director, but it could also be like, whoever is the most famous or powerful or successful member of the crew who's able to steer things in various directions. Willems argued, and I think convincingly, that if the Mission Impossible franchise has an auteur, it's Tom Cruise.
Of course it is!
And for this one, if I was going to say spot the auteur, it'd be Heinz Edelman. Like, the first thing that anyone thinks of with Yellow Submarine, it's the character designs, it's the design for the submarine itself. It's very iconic, it sticks right out. As soon as you see it, you don't mistake it for anything else. And as George Harrison himself put it, he's kind of the guiding hand behind the film. I think it wouldn't have worked without him.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, as much as everything else contributed to it as well, animation is, as I put it, a very collaborative medium on several previous podcasts. I do think that auteur theory has a number of severe limitations for a medium as collaborative as film. I think it's a little regressive to claim that a film has to have one principal author.
Yeah, and auteur theory is also like, he was an asshole, but look how beautiful the movie was. Let's ignore all of the abuses that happened, especially the ones to women and children.
Or, you know, the Twilight Zone movie that actually killed people.
Mm-hmm. And, like, I watched a really interesting documentary on cursed films, and they do talk about the Twilight Zone one, but they also interview Linda Blair. And even now, all these years later, you can see how fucking angry she is about how she was treated by Friedkin on set.
What bothers me the most about auteur theory is that it harkens back to an era where it was generally accepted that collaborative forms of art were lesser than ones that came from a singular genius, which is, I think, a very dubious assumption to make. But I suppose another lens that we could view the film through is, well, I suppose we can't really do feminist film theory because there aren't any women in the movie, although you could certainly examine it through that lens for that reason.
There is no token female Blue Meanie, the Blue Meanie-ette.
Yeah, there's no lovely Rita.
Yeah. Besides, I think you don't really want to talk about the Beatles and women on a podcast without that. Isn't going to be like 3 fucking hours long.
I suppose they're less shitty than the Rolling Stones or Dylan, but...
I mean, I will say, just for the record, Team Yoko Ono. Fuck John Lennon.
Well, Yoko Ono is a legit artist, and she was established before she married John Lennon. I think marrying John Lennon was the worst thing she could do for her career. She'd be a respected artist if she didn't become the most anonymous, incredibly famous person in the world.
Yeah, I listened to her. She has a collaborative album that's fairly new, and she teams up with, like, Peaches, and it's really cool.
Yeah, Peaches seems like somebody who'd make a record with Yoko Ono.
Yes.
I guess that's enough. We're basically at the 1 hour mark. Is there anything you'd like to say about Yellow Submarine before we sign off?
No, I'm glad I finally watched it. I don't know if I would have liked it as much as I did this time had I watched it as a child. I don't know why.
I'm pretty sure I would have been in love with this as a kid, or if I had watched it yesterday. This is exactly my type of joint. So thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next time.
Peace and love.